Welcome to episode 59. I'm Stuart McCullough, I'm the CEO of VHAA. And starting with this week's industrial roundup, and in particular with community health. Our discussions for community health have entered a really interesting stage. This week we have our monthly meeting with the HRIR managers from community health, and we have a number of proposals for settlement for consideration by the sector. In particular, proposals for settlement for the allied health professionals, medical scientists, and health and allied services agreement. Meanwhile, with respect to the SACS agreement, which was the subject of a successful ballot that proceeds towards lodgement and approval by the Fair Work Commission. With regards to our health service members, on the 16th of April, we're meeting with the ANMF and DHHS with regards to the NUM structure review. For the doctors, we are meeting with the HMO group on April the 18th, and part of that meeting will be just to work through and settle the list of implementation issues that we will then be working on for that agreement, for those agreements. We're also attending a health practice stakeholder working group, which is conducted by WorkSafe on the 19th of April, and an SDPPWG meeting with the ANMF on the same day. As always, all of our activities are summarised through the VHA community app. And that's it for this week's Industrial Roundup. Welcome to the weekly update, where we go in depth with a particular subject. And joining me for this week's discussion is consultant Alec Jonoff. Welcome, Alec.
Thank you, Stuart. Pleasure to be here.
Alec, would you be good enough to reveal the clue for this week's discussion?
I'll do my best.
So for the benefit of those people who are listening to this podcast rather than watching, would you be good enough to describe the object that is this week's clue?
It does look a bit like a babushka doll, but... right, okay. With an emblem of Lenin on it. What else it might signify, I'm in your hands.
It's probably better for me to demonstrate as such. So here we have Vladimir Ilyich Lenin. In 1924, he takes a permanent vacation, and he is replaced. Not directly by this guy, but eventually by this guy. And then at some point, he also goes and takes a permanent vacation and is replaced. And we have this guy. I don't know if you recall who this guy is.
Brezhnev.
Brezhnev, I think, had... He was
preceded by Khrushchev.
Brezhnev, I always like to think of as being the Russian leader that most resembled Ernest Borgnine. And I think that his eyebrows were really... They extended the Cold War by about 10 years.
Yes, they would have had a frosty effect.
Или это где мой парень?
These leaders, each replacing the other, brings us to this week's subject, which of course is backfill. So we're talking about backfill. And just as Russian leaders are backfilled from time to time, we're talking about the obligations arising under the Medical Scientists Agreement with respect to backfill. So first things first, when did the Medical Scientists Agreement, the new Medical Scientists Agreement, come into effect?
28th of December 2017.
And this particular clause that we're talking about in terms of planned and unplanned absences and backfill has been identified as a key implementation issue. In addition to this podcast, there's also a VHA bulletin with regards to this subject?
That's correct. Bulletin number 2274 was issued by us yesterday.
And just so that members have an understanding of how it is that we get to a bulletin before we issue it, did we consult with the union?
Yes, it's like many of the matters that we're dealing with, these are matters of implementation, and we have a standing commitment to not only consult with the unions on implementation matters, but as a matter of course also with the department.
And so we've established that the agreement is now in operation. This clause that we're going to be talking about today is in effect. There is additional information in the form of a member bulletin. So first of all, Alec, where will members find this particular provision within the agreement?
Oh, clause 34.
I think one of the interesting things about that, the location of the clause, is not just where it's located in the agreement, but its neighbours. It's in a part of the agreement, part 5, which is headed workforce management, and it's preceded by a workload clause. It's followed by advertising and filling of vacancies provision, and those clauses seem to have something in common in the form of managing or responding to workload in some form.
Yes, indeed. That was clearly the intention of the parties. There's been much discussion about workforce management related matters, not only in this agreement but in many others, and it was very, very appropriate that these related matters be bunched together in the agreement for ease of reference and so on.
So just as we have started off today's discussion by going over historical figures, before we get to the present, let's go back to the past and talk about the clauses that have preceded the introduction of this provision. It has a preceding provision in effect.
Yes, it does. Clause 67 of the previous agreement, which very substantially, but not to this extent, had similar componentry and so similar obligations.
It was a shorter clause.
Much shorter clause.
I think it had a couple of distinct components to that clause. What were those components?
Well, the essential components were that backfill is to be provided where there's an absence of 2 weeks or more. That was 10 days, but two working weeks.
My recollection is that it had that there was an agreement to do those things. And
correct.
Then the sentence finished with the term where practicable, which strikes me as a potentially problematic term. Was there much discussion during the negotiations about the operating effect of where practicable?
Yes, this particular provision, the whole notion of backfill and workforce manager was the subject of very extensive discussion, debate, argument between the parties. What became quite apparent, and many of our reference group members also confirmed this, that the words where practicable tended to also lead to disputation because it was very subjective, it was very much in the eye of the beholder. And we were looking for a mechanism by which disputation could be averted.
Disputation for me is always a sign that a clause is not doing its job.
It's not doing its job, precisely.
And so that's led to then taking the existing commitment but making it less ambiguous and clearer and tighter.
Well, let's not mince words. It is more prescriptive in the detail than the previous clause. It spells out in very clear terms what the obligations of the employer are. And to that extent, it is a tighter provision, but it is also a clearer provision. And at the end of the day, both parties realised that was going to be to their mutual benefit.
So in terms of the obligation to replace after 10 days, that of itself is not new, but the degree of prescription and precision within the clause has substantially increased.
That's correct.
So that's the history, and that's what's brought us to the current clause 34.
Yep.
Can you take us through the obligations that arise under that clause?
Well, there's two components. There is planned absences, and then there are unplanned absences. So if we start with planned absences, they are very clear. The object is to ensure that there are safe staffing work levels and vacancies that arise through a backfill obligation must be backfilled. There are outs to that, but they are very clear as to what they are and what their limits are.
That point that you picked up on as to how the clause starts under 34.1A, where it does talk about the objective, in effect, of the clause,
correct,
which is to maintain safe work levels, which goes to that part of the fact that it sits with other clauses that are all about workload and workload management. But then that distinction between planned and unplanned.
Yep.
But in terms of planned and the term planned leave, because terms like leave or planned leave weren't defined previously.
Correct.
How have they been defined for the new agreement?
They've been very explicitly defined, and a reference to the bulletin issued yesterday and the clause itself makes it very clear. Leave is defined as being annual leave, parental leave, long service, unpaid leave, professional development leave, study leave, and work cover absences. So it's quite explicit as to what it covers and, by definition, what it doesn't.
That's interesting. That is a very broad description of what constitutes leave.
Correct.
It's really more about absence. But it defines leave in terms of type of leave, but also to be planned leave for the purpose of this clause, time is a factor.
It must be 2 weeks.
2 weeks or more.
2 weeks or more.
And in terms of those obligations, then, what is the obligation in the context of a planned leave that's 2 weeks or more under that provision?
Well, backfill simply means replacement of the person who's on leave by someone of equal competence to do the job that has been vacated by that person on leave.
And in terms of the obligation for backfill, when does it commence?
The day that the vacancy or the absence occurs.
So the first day of leave.
First day of leave is effectively the day upon which backfill must occur, unless there are circumstances that preclude it, and we'll come to that in a moment.
And just in terms of the features of the person who is backfilling, in terms of classification level and hours, are there requirements in that respect?
The person who provides the backfill must be paid at least at the same level as the position that they're backfilling for. So they're acting up or they're going sideways. Either way, they've got to go into the job and be paid for the rate of the job.
So just to cover off all the potential questions that could arise from that, if someone from a higher classification was stepping in and backfilling to a lower classified role, they would presumably not reduce their remuneration.
They retain their arrangements because it's at the requirement of the employer. The employer requires them to fill that position, then they have to retain their existing contractual arrangements.
So the obligation to backfill is, in a sense, absolute. It is not where practicable.
No.
It's at a much higher level than that.
It is a much stronger test, and the exceptions to it are more limited.
Because there's always the possibility that despite best endeavours, and the clause refers to best endeavours, that backfill may not be possible.
That's correct.
What happens in those circumstances?
Under the terms of the clause, where a position cannot be filled despite best endeavours, then a rearrangement of the existing workload has to occur such that no one acquires an excessive workload.
So we'll go into that in a little bit more detail in a moment, but one of the things that struck me is that reference to suitably qualified and experienced person who may not be available. So it recognises that suitably qualified and experienced people aren't simply behind a pane of glass in break in case of emergency.
Correct.
They may not be available as such.
That's correct.
What are reasons why such people may not be available?
It could be a variety of reasons. One is the particular position has a relatively rare skill set or rare role.
Because we do have
or
people.
It could be a timing issue. There could be a variety of reasons why someone of a suitable skill and qualification is not available.
So one of the interesting things for this agreement for me is that it has some people who are extraordinarily specialised, who indeed finding somebody who is suitably qualified and experienced to replace them might be extremely difficult.
Yes, that's indeed so. As we all know, there are highly specialised areas of pathology, and it's not easy to transfer a haematologist across to biochemistry and so on. The backfill arrangements tend to occur within those disciplines, and to that extent there are sometimes limitations on what is available to suitably backfill.
Just to emphasise again, I guess it's a much higher, you must make a best effort, best
Absolutely.
Endeavour.
Absolutely, a best endeavour.
Which is a much, much higher proposition than where practicable.
Absolutely. Very much so.
So before we get into what happens if it is that you can't find a suitably qualified and experienced person to replace, and before we move on to talking about the provisions with regards to unplanned leave, you made a reference before to the reference group.
Yes.
And I just wanted to unpack a little bit what the involvement of the reference group and the contribution that a reference group makes to the development of a clause as important or significant within an agreement is this?
Correct. I think everyone knows that each of the EBAs has had their reference group. no different in this particular case. In this particular round of bargaining with the Medical Scientists Association, there were three or four areas that were of quite challenging. Rostering arrangements, workload, backfill, and progression from grade one to grade two. They were four or five really big, controversial, difficult matters that had to be worked through, and we engaged with the reference group pretty much on a weekly basis over many, many months until we got to a set of words that everyone felt they could live with and operate, and felt that it was going to enable the backfill arrangements to work in the manner in which the words intend.
So moving on from then the planned absence, which we've covered off, into the realm of unplanned absences. What are the obligations with regards to replacement or backfill of those on unplanned absences?
Well, the obligation is no different in that it's for unplanned absences of a period of 2 weeks or more.
The threshold
is the same. It's precisely the same, as it has always has been. But of course, unplanned absences are just that. They're unplanned. They're random. They can't often be predicted. And so they're the sort of things that an employer has to come to grips with rapidly, simply because of that randomness.
Whilst the threshold for a requirement to act is the same, it's quite prescriptive in terms of what the action steps are and makes distinctions in terms of on-call and the like. What are those distinctions?
Well, the distinctions are relatively simple, and they're actually spelled out quite clearly in the agreement. In respect of on-call, we have a day's gap. So unless the absence is advised after 4 p.m. on the day before, an employee who's rostered on call will not be recalled, because we always have people placed on call. And the essence of that, for purposes of backfill, is only to be used as a last resort.
So you are attempting to backfill with somebody else?
Some other than the person who is rostered to be on call, because they're there for emergency purposes. And in this case, you only recall for a backfill purpose an on-call person as a last resort. Once you've exhausted all the other options for acquiring a backfill person.
So effectively, rather than taking the most direct option, it requires...
You have to go through a sequence.
And that presumably will assist to reduce the level of recall?
It should. That's its purpose. Its purpose. I mean, having a scientist on call is for well-defined purposes.
So that's the issue in the context of on-call.
Yep.
What about the obligations with respect to other employees?
Well, everyone else also has that obligation. They have to be replaced at the same grade, at the same level. So the basic provision applies to all.
So we've covered off the planned and the unplanned absence component. Mm. That does take us to the bit of, yes, it's an obligation, it's not optional, it's mandatory, but what if you can't?
Yes, that's right.
That is something that is actively contemplated at subclause 3 of the agreement. What are the provisions with regards to where you can't find a suitably qualified or experienced person to backfill?
The general concept is where you can't, and frankly you have to be able to demonstrate that you can't, we'll come to that in a moment, is that the workload must be prioritised in accordance with the clause.
It's interesting, that really takes us back to the reason for the clause, workload.
Precisely. It's about management of a workload, and management has they've always had the obligation. This time round, the clause is more explicit about the articulation of that obligation of reprioritising workloads.
So in terms of that
redistribution of work.
In terms of that prioritisation and that redistribution, what does the clause have to say with regards to those?
It simply says where employees are, they basically, what it says is, once you've redistributed and you still can't get all the work done, then some work has to drop off. Mm. Now, that rolls off the tongue quite nicely. On a practical level in some workplaces, that mightn't be quite so simple. That means there has to be a far greater level of engagement in relation to backfill arrangements, prioritisation of work, and decisions about how work is to be distributed and what work has which priority.
It really emphasises that the responsibility for managing workload falls to the employer.
Absolutely, but in this case, it is more explicit that they need to engage with the workforce who is going to be accepting the reprioritised work. So there is that stronger level of engagement with to ensure that redistribution, reprioritisation is done in a manner that isn't going to create tensions and dispute.
It's interesting. So there are those two distinct elements. There is the engagement, which involves everyone.
Absolutely.
But there is responsibility, which ultimately rests with the employer, which makes sense in the context of the responsibility to provide a safe work environment.
It is just a clause that is extremely more explicit about a long-standing obligation of employers.
I wanted to touch a little bit on record keeping, because that is an interesting part of that clause and what the obligations on members are in terms of record keeping so far as their attempts to replace.
Yes. What is now required, the provision makes clear that the union must, if it requests it, be provided with evidence of the attempts to backfill. And in that sense, it's a stronger obligation. So the obligation is to record in writing what you have done in attempting to backfill. And the union is entitled to ask for evidence of that. Because that goes to the issue of, we haven't been able to backfill, but we have gone through a reprioritisation process. The union may well contest that. And you need to have the evidence. In other words, have a transparent process to show that all best endeavours have been engaged in.
It's interesting. The focus in the clause is on recording the efforts and the best endeavours to replace. Would you recommend that members also record their efforts to reprioritise if it comes to that?
Clearly the clause doesn't of itself specify that, but any prudent employer will have sufficient documentation to say, I have now reprioritised and redistributed work in the following way, and this will ensure that the priorities of work in any particular laboratory can be assured of being given the attention they require in the timeframes that are stipulated.
What strikes me is that that reference to the union being able to request the written evidence, it means that the term best endeavours effectively can come under scrutiny, can be tested, can be ultimately considered by a third party.
Correct. It is capable of being disputed. Just like where practicable, it was capable of being disputed. But that was far more messy. This is about an absence of a document that says, these are the efforts I've made.
So just to recap the obligations under Clause 34. The clause requires the replacement of those on planned and unplanned leave for periods of 2 weeks, or more.
Absolutely.
It provides that where backfill has not been able to occur because a suitably experienced and qualified person is not available, that workload is prioritised.
Correct.
And that members are required, if they can't find a suitably qualified and experienced person, to record their best endeavours in writing.
Absolutely.
That we would recommend, in addition to that, that people record what steps they take to reprioritise work, and that engagement with staff is a high priority.
It's important that there be transparency, because that's the path to minimising disputation.
And lastly, Alec, in the bulletin we foreshadowed some work of the Service Delivery Partnership Plan Working Group, and in particular the proposed establishment of a public health relief pool. I wanted to know just what the progress with regards to that relief pool was and what effect it might have on the operation of Clause 34.
Well, of course, the linkage between the potential creation of a pool and Clause 34 is relatively obvious. It will give stability, certainty and access for backfill capacity should it become created. So that's one of its key objectives. But well beyond that, there has been a strong feeling that a relief pool in pharmacy and pathology is desirable. That's not unprecedented in the health industry. We had those years ago. But there is a strong mood for that to occur, and that's now in the SDP PWG process. All parties are very supportive of it. We've been speaking to health services, it looks as though there's at least two major metropolitan health services who are willing to be active participants in the running of such a pool. They are doing some analysis of the resource requirements and how that might be, in a practical way, implemented. The department is very supportive of it, and we're very hopeful that the department will provide, at the very least, some seed funding to enable that pool process to occur. So there's still a lot of work to be done, but there's a lot of positivity between the parties about bringing that about.
Okay. Alec, thank you so much for taking us through Clause 34 of the Medical Scientists Agreement with regards to planned and unplanned absences. I guess the only way for us to finish is to find out who's replacing Ernest Borgnine here. Would you like to hazard a guess?
No, I won't. I'll allow myself to be surprised.
So we have Boris Yeltsin, a leader who distinguished himself by once being too drunk to get off an aeroplane when visiting Ireland, from memory.
He did.
And last but not least.
Oh, there's another one, is
there? There is. There's always another one. Backfill.
And Mr.
Putin. Who better to backfill than Putin?
And he will never require backfill according to all political puppets.
No, he's there forever.
He's there forever.
Indeed. Thank you, Alan.
Thank you.